Coming to you from Canada, Australia, and New York, this is an all-new episode of The Process, a bi-weekly discussion about comic book writing from the perspective of the writers. Before we get started, I'd like to introduce my co-host joining me tonight. First off, we have the awesome Aussie, Ryan K. Lindsay. Between updating us with his insightful reviews for such sites as The Weekly Crisis and Comic Book Resources, he manages to also be writing his own stories and keeps us updated with his various projects by way of his blog, stinkbrown.org. Rounding out our little trio is a man who needs a little introduction. Curtis Weeb is the writer of two wildly successful Image comics, Greenwake and The Intrepids. While living the dream and producing the amount of work of a full-time writer, he also maintains the reality of a day job. And I'm Jeremy Holt. I write comic book reviews for the entertainment site Joyhog, and I'm also a comic book writer with enough rejection letters to fill a scrapbook, but with enough promising pitches to fill two. You can follow the progress of my work on my blog, clubofthrees.wordpress.com. Welcome, guys, and thanks for joining me. How are you guys doing?
We are doing all right, I think.
Doing fantastic.
Awesome.
You've survived the day at least anyway, Ryan. Why don't you fill us in what's happened? We were supposed to record this yesterday, but there was a catastrophe at your place.
Well, my superheroic alter ego got pulled off into the denizens of a black hole, and I just sadly could not make it to sit down at the computer, which is, you know, really what I wish had happened. But instead, as you mentioned earlier, Kurt, I let my child socialize, and when you do that, they socialize with germs. And, of course, those germs come home to roost, and there was no way I was going to last an hour at the computer yesterday. So, thankfully, you guys were able to wait for me, so thanks for that.
Well, yeah. You know what? I think the solution for that really is, and this is something that I find has worked really well for me, is to not have kids.
Yeah, or you just have let your siblings have kids, and you get to play with them. But you don't have to really deal with all of that stuff.
That's true. That's actually not a bad point.
So where were you guys like 8 months ago to give a heads up on that one?
a little too little, a little too late,
yeah,
I guess.
Hindsight's 2020.
Hey, that's what she said 8 months ago. Sorry, I couldn't hesitate.
Yeah. I'm really looking forward to the show. It's the last one I think was pretty successful. We had quite a few comments from readers and listeners out on the Twitterverse and we on our Facebook page, and we really appreciate everyone tuning in. We've kind of tried to do a bit of a little guide, so we actually have some kind of guiding point as to what we're doing with the show rather than just kind of rambling on, which I mean, I guess it worked out okay, but I think this format's gonna work, and so we'll kind of break it down as we go through. But I don't know, why don't we move right into the first section? Ryan, you're gonna be the one to do this one for us.
Excellent. All right, listeners, strap on your hats. We're getting into the wow factor for this week. Now, what the wow factor is, each of us are going to pick some piece of comic writing that we've been indulging ourselves in over the past week, and we're just going to dissect it and discuss it and see what we can come up with from it. I'll lead off the bat, I guess, and what I'll be looking at today is Mystery Men from Marvel Comics, written by David Liss and illustrated by Patrick Zercher. Have you guys picked up Mystery Men at all?
No.
I haven't. Riley's been telling me to read it, so I have to get on it.
Yeah, so he's got good taste. It's an interesting book. It's set in the Marvel Universe, and they sort of, I think it's about the 1920s, and it's sort of like the first set of a heroic supergroup that came up in the sort of the pulp days. Now, David Liss is a writer who's pretty new to comics. He's written a bunch of historical novels, but he's also been writing Black Panther, The Man Without Fear, which has had its ups and downs. It's had some good parts, though. In this series, though, he's really trying to get that pulp sensibility, which it's you cross that fine line between homage and almost a parody. And he's doing a really good job of just making it feel authentic, which I think is amazing. And in issue 3, the story sort of takes a bit of a backseat, and we introduce two new characters for this group, the Mystery Men. And the one character I want to talk about in his sequence is the Surgeon. Now, the Surgeon starts off as this guy in West Virginia, I believe. And he's the local doc, and you know he's a little too good at heart. He always wants to sort of help out. And there's some union strikes going on, and basically the cops have told him he's not allowed to help anyone who's on strike. And he eventually does. This guy's about to die, and so the doc steps in and saves his life. And then that night his house is set on fire. And the first three pages sort of give you that lead-in, and it's relatively straightforward storytelling. And once his house gets set on fire, the panels all break and start to sort of skew to the side, or they look a little bit fragmented. And you can see he completely burns up in, or not completely, he gets set alight in the fire. And you see this panel of him out the front, and he's sort of like a charred corpse. He kind of looks like Haunt from Image Comics. He's got that real sketchy lined style. It's quite creepy. And he manages to make it to his car, and he gets some drugs out of there. And I'm assuming it's sort of morphine, even though it's Reanimator Green. I don't know exactly what medicine in a syringe comes in Reanimator Green, but he sets himself up, and he bandages himself up in a new sort of costume. But he says, and this is me reading from there, "I have no need to look fashionable or preposterous. I'll wear the garb of my profession, and I will never neglect my duty to prevent the spread of infection." See, it's got this almost Frank Miller parody vibe, but it's just, it's too much fun not to like. And he then goes about, and he's completely wrapped head to toe. He almost looks like a mummy or the Invisible Man. He's got this a medical jacket on and a great big red cape, and he goes around injecting people and slicing off fingers with a scalpel, and he's just trying to bring justice, I guess. But there's one really great panel, and it just sort of, it cracked me up as I read it, but it's him. He's leaving his town, and he's saying how he is dead, and he's now the surgeon. And the caption reads, "I have to get to New York to find the people who had done this to me, to my town." And what the panel shows is the surgeon on top of a bus, riding the bus. Now, Jeremy, maybe you can help me. How far is West Virginia from New York?
I'm going to just guess. I think it's about maybe 6 hours maybe.
So the surgeon rides on top of a bus for 6 hours to New York. I think that's kind of cool. It's just, and it's a throwaway panel, and the very, like, it's got him walking out of town, him riding a bus, and then it's got the New York City night skyline. I don't want to be bored to death with how he gets to New York. I don't really care, quite honestly. And I like that whole throwing him on top of the bus. It reminded me of Raiders of the Lost Ark, where he whips the submarine, and then it just cuts to the map, and you see the dotted line go along. And did Indiana yeah. Jones really ride that submarine across, like, the Pacific? Who knows? And you don't really care. And I think that's the important part with this book. It's not that you don't care about the book, but superfluous details. You don't need to follow a character from the moment they wake up to them having a coffee, taking a morning juice, and then thinking about what they're going to do for the day. You just need to sort of get into it, and that's what this book does. And I think it's the best stuff David Liss has done so far. I was a really big fan of this and the previous issues. He's bringing a real quality pulp sensibility to it. But just this one panel of the surgeon riding the bus, I just thought, yeah, that's authentic to exactly what the comic should be.
That sounds really interesting. I liked what you said about the, you know, cutting to the chase and just getting to the parts that are important. I think, especially for me in my early writing, I remember I actually worked with an editor on Snow Angel with Arcana, and the original script, I mean, it was one of the first things I'd written, and he made some really good points about, you know, you're adding way too many panels here. You're doing all these transitions that nobody cares about. You know, I'm showing her walk out of the room, walk up to her dad. She leans over, she reaches into his pocket, she pulls out the keys, she walks to the door, she opens, and it was just like, it's all these details that people can fill in with their brains. You don't have to fill everything out for them. Yeah. And that there's definitely something to be said about being able to pick the precise moment that is the one that what people want to see, and that tells the story the most efficiently.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think that, you know, I think it's something you said, Ryan, in our last discussion about, you know, how film has 24 frames, and when you slow it down, that's what you were really enjoying about some of those movies you were watching. And it's, you're right. Yeah. I mean, it's basically about catching the right moment, and that right moment has to say more than the words that you could possibly fill in a balloon, because it's supposed to also support the lettering. And if you can do that, you know, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, definitely. It's something to really think about, and you've got to think about what you need to get across. And it is that, it's that necessity. Do you need to have filler? And especially with any medium, I don't think you need to have filler. And yet people, I don't know whether they languish into it or they trip over it, or it's hard to say why it happens sometimes. You forget that readers can, I mean, they talk about with comics closure, which is the distance between one panel to the next, and that your mind will fill in what happens in that sense of closure, where it doesn't need to be a moving frame like a movie is. A comic can just show someone walking to the door and then have them walking outside their building, and you know they probably walk down the stairs to do it, but you don't need to see it.
Right. And Ryan, I wanted to ask you, I know that, you know, Curtis has already experienced this by, you know, he has written scripts and he's seen the art and it's, he's seen print, but when you write your scripts, I know for me, I've written a lot of things in my earlier scripts. When I saw artists, when I actually saw the first page of whatever I wrote was actually drawn, it made me realize like I had to change a lot of things. Like I was, like Curtis said, adding too many things that weren't necessary. And I wasn't really thinking about the art when I was writing it. I'm wondering if you've had that experience yourself.
Yeah, I find it's really interesting. Like a lot of the writers, let's say for Marvel at the moment, like Brubaker, he can draw and he has drawn before, and Bendis can kind of draw and he's drawn before. And I cannot draw for the life of me. Like I have no artistic sensibility whatsoever. I'm lucky to get a stick figure without breaking it. And yet I try to really bring a visual mindset to anything that I write. I try to sort of plot it out as to how it would look on the page, how many panels it would take. As for then how an artist interprets that and whether it's possible, that's still a little outside my scope, sadly. But I do try and bring that visual idea to it. And sometimes you just need to see it drawn, or you need to have an artist call you on it. But usually the artists that I've worked with haven't had too much issue with either fitting everything in or having it make sense or having it flow. Reading some very early scripts that I haven't shown to artists, some of them it's just clogged down. You want all this dynamic action in the panel, but you also want a bunch of captions there, and that's just not going to work.
Yeah, you learn that pretty early on once you attach an artist and they basically tell you either nicely or not so nicely, don't ever do that again.
I think that
definitely
most people don't give writers enough credit as, you know, everybody thinks that when you make a comic book, the writer provides the words and the artist provides the art. But honestly, a writer, especially guys that are starting out doing creator-owned books, the writer has to have some kind of sensibility towards art, whether they took an art class in college or, you know, I know that I almost majored in art history in school. And I know that Nathan Edmondson had also mentioned he had some extensive background in fine arts or, you know, the study of art. And, you know, writers need to have that sensibility because you could write a script, but you might look at something and it may actually not be any good. But if you don't have just a basic sense of, you know, composition and colors and just basic art sensibility, then, you know, sometimes it just doesn't work, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, definitely. It's one of those things I think you have to learn by doing to a fair degree. You can go in with your own theories and thoughts and you can read comics and sort of deconstruct how they work. But in the end, you've got to see how your voice meshes with the page. And so I think just, you know, writing those 10,000 pages of crap will hopefully slowly get you there. We'll go to Jeremy. Do you have a wow factor section for this week?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Real quick, the Homeland Directive by Robert Venditti and Mike Huddleston. I wouldn't say it's a panel per se, but I would say it's probably pages 1-7 really illustrate the fact that, you know, Venditti wrote a really, really compelling story, and he wrote something that I like to read, which is something based in reality, based around a very real situation involving the government. This very big conspiracy around a virus of some sort that is spreading and nobody can figure out why and what the government has, you know, what their purpose is for it. And it's, you know, follows this one doctor who I assume is some kind of virologist of some sorts, and she's kind of the key to all this, so she's being blamed for it. And it kind of shows you how far the government can reach into affecting perception on a mass scale. But the art is what really ties it all together, because Mike Huddleston, you know, Venditti wrote a very tight, very well-researched script, but Huddleston does this really great thing between pages 1-7 where they look dynamically different. The first three pages take place in the White House, and they're like this really painted, nice washed-over look, very refined, and then it cuts to this very gritty work that you might recognize immediately from Huddleston, and it's taking place at a different location, but you immediately feel it because of the difference in the art. And I thought that was brilliant, because most people want to try to stay consistent because they're afraid, you know, I don't want to lose the reader while they're reading this. But he went the complete opposite direction, and I asked Robert about it earlier today, and he said that it was all Mike that decided to just go dynamic colors, complete changes when it changed locations in the story, and it just totally works, and it becomes cinematic without even really trying, which is really great.
That's pretty cool. I saw that at the store just last week, and I've been thinking about picking it up because Huddleston, man, he's an artist to watch. I don't know how much work he's done previously, but I've been tracking him on Butcher Baker, and it is phenomenal.
Yep. His stuff. We were chatting before the show, Jeremy and I, and I would just mention The Coffin. If you have not read that, for the love of God, please do. There's not a lot of books that comics that really creep me out, but there's some philosophies and imagery in there that it really unsettled me. And the art is out of this world. And that's, it's a Huddleston book. I can't recommend that book enough.
Nice. I'm going to have to clearly invest in a few extra books of his, because there's something about his style where it's, I guess you just automatically say it's different, but it's really got a flow, and it does. It catches the eye, even though it chops and changes even within a page. And I think that's a real strength.
It's very dynamic, and it's certainly more toned down than Butcher Baker, but his sensibility is there, and he certainly knows how to tell the story. It's a perfect marriage of just a great script, a great concept, realized through the art. So definitely a good read.
Cool
quality. All right, Kurt, what have you got for this week?
Well, I'm going back a little ways here. I hadn't actually read this when it came out, and I've been a huge fan of Brian Wood. So I went out and got myself a demo, and I got the trade. So the story that really kind of hooked me was Bad Blood. And it's the story about these half siblings, Sean and Samantha, and basically they're meeting at a funeral of their shared father, and they haven't seen each other since they were kids. And basically the whole story that I really liked. I have a real love on for stories about where people kind of reflect and look forward to things that, the way things could have been and look how they've turned out, and kind of that reflective nature of the story. I just really like the sequence, and basically they hang out after the funeral. They're talking about dad. They're bitching about, kind of that he was kind of useless to them. But there's just this on page 69 of the trade. Samantha has this. They're driving out in the middle of the forest, and she's looking out. I'm looking at the book right now. It's just beautiful art, Becky Cloonan, and they're just driving out in the middle of nowhere, and she has this flashback. It's just two panels, and they're kids, and she's sitting on a bike, and he's there, and he's just kind of got his hand on the bike, and they have this really quiet moment, and they both smile, and then we cut back to the modern time, and she's got this look of sorrow on her face, and the caption just says "another lifetime," and it's just so good. I mean that whole short is great, and it ends on such a twist that you see it one way, and he just kind of flips it on his head at the very end, and you're like, well played, Brian Wood, well played. So yeah, that's my pick. That's definitely my pick for the wow factor this week.
That's interesting. The arts, it sounds like it really carries that one. It's not all the words.
Becky Cloonan did the art, right?
Yeah, Becky Cloonan did the art on that one. And I think this is some of her earlier stuff. And she's progressed quite a lot. This stuff is fairly manga, and she still has that influence in her stuff now, but this is a lot. There's a pretty big difference between this and what she's doing now.
Awesome.
So there you go. I guess that's the wow factor. We're going to move on to the next section. I'll introduce it. Basically what we are doing is called the progress report. And the three of us are all currently working on different projects. Some are pitching, some are, in the process of like waiting on hearing back from editors, publishers, and some of us are extremely behind on our work and should be doing that instead of podcasting. But here we are. So this is called the progress report, and this is where we just want to talk a bit about our personal projects, maybe some victories we've had over the last few weeks. And I guess I'll start things off. I have been working on, surprise, surprise, Green Lake. And in the middle of that, I had a email from my novel publisher who sent me the first round of edits for my novel. And so to add to the growing pile, I decided, well, you know what, I may as well focus on this. It doesn't look like it's too heavy. And I kind of want to just mention how going back, and I wrote this novel about 4 years ago, and going back and getting in the heads of these characters and 4 years ago. That is a difficult place to go. I don't know if you guys have ever gone back maybe a year or two after writing a script and trying to either redo or edit, but it is it's an interesting process. I found it difficult at first just because I hadn't even thought about the characters and, you know, since, I don't know, about 2 years ago. And I just sat down. I did most of the edits in one night. And if I get everything done on schedule, the projected date for my novel to come out is September 30th. So it's kind of a priority to get that done so I can have a little bit more content if I go to cons to sell. So that's kind of what I'm working on at the moment. How about you, Ryan? What did you get accomplished this week?
Besides being incredibly sick, I did before then manage to get a few pages out. I'm still working on a pitch for a book with an artist at the moment. He's sort of turning in pages. We've got about one to go before it's ready to start shopping around. So I've just started writing a bit further ahead in that issue and just sort of resculpting things. And I'm finding that I'm getting a better view of the characters just through writing a bit more with them, obviously. I think the more you write a character, the more you know them, and the more you see them react, and the more you see them act. And I think that's really powerful, so that when I get into email chats with publishers or hopefully calls as well, I can really discuss these characters inside and out. So that's been good. I probably churned out maybe half a dozen pages earlier on in the week, and I was really happy with one two-page sequence, which... The book is about, it's a heist on a cryptozoological zoo, or it's kind of like the Guantanamo Bay of cryptids. So it's this building that just looks like an office building in the middle of New York, but it's actually floor to floor just full of cells for werewolves and griffins and black pegasuses and all, or pegasi. All sorts of different creatures are in there. And so there's a two-page sequence where the heist team are looking at the building and they're talking about sort of what it is exactly. And by the time I'd finished writing the two pages, I realized that one of those characters basically wants to have sex with that building. And it wasn't something I planned, I swear to God, but he's talking about it. He's like, yeah, isn't it just a gorgeous building sort of thing? And he's just going on and on about it. And then in the end, he's just like... oh man, this building's so gorgeous, you could take it out on a date and you'd be happy with a handshake. But we're going to ask for more than just intimacy. We're going inside her. And I thought, man, this guy is messed up. He's not the lead character. He's the foil. But, oh man, he's clearly a little bit warped. And I knew what line I was going to end the page with, and then these lines sort of filled it in the middle. And... yeah, it's nice to write something and still have it surprise you in places, which I really kind of dig that process where you can be, you know, chewing along and then you don't say something for the character, your character says something. And that always sounds like such an almost pretentious thing to say, but it's true. You create a good character, they will start to speak for themselves. Oh, and I really, yeah, it's a powerful thing to experience. So that's been a good process of writing those pages. And he ends the scene by saying, after he says we're going inside her, and take that as you will, he then says, and we're going to steal that which does not exist. And I may fiddle around with the syntax of that sentence, but I like that concept. He's going in there. No one knows what's in this building. It's an office building in New York. You're not going to get door knockers and, you know, cookie sales girls and all that sort of stuff. It's just it's got good security, which people would assume for New York City at the moment. And No one knows that half of these creatures exist. By the time they surface, the government obviously picks them up, plops them in this building, and they're never heard from again. So that's been going really well. And the other thing I'll quickly plug is I run a website also called Thought Balloons. And you can find it at www.thought-balloons.com. And what we do there is there's a bunch of us writers on there. I think we're up to about 9 at the moment, where each week we pick a character. And then each of us write one page of script for that character. And so it doesn't need to be a full story. It can be one page. It can be a splash page. It can be whatever you like. As long as you're not rewriting a scene that already exists, you can tiptoe through the raindrops however you like. And it's been a really fun growing experience as a writer to do this site. We've been going for a bit over a year now. And I don't know when this podcast will drop, so I can probably spoil it. Next week's character is Captain America because of the movie, obviously. And so I had to come up with a one-page script for Cap, and it had to be set in World War II. That was the caveat that we placed on ourselves. So I sort of, as I do when writing these sorts of things, I went online and did a bit of research. And, you know, you just sort of let yourself surf the links and see what sort of comes up. And I dug up, the first interesting thing was a rotor buggy, which apparently in World War II, the Americans were toying with this idea of basically turning a Jeep into a helicopter. And it's the dumbest looking thing you ever saw. And so I thought, oh, could I maybe weave that in? And that was the start. And I realized if I had like Cap parachuting out of some rotor buggy, it would probably look very Mark Miller. So I kept sort of searching for other weird stuff. And there was this other invention that the Yanks had toyed with during World War II, which was pikecrete. And basically what it was is it's a material made of ice and wood pulp, and they were looking to build ships out of it. And during a demonstration, they had a block of pikecrete and a block of ice, and they shot the block of ice and it shattered, as you'd expect. They shot the block of pikecrete and it didn't do anything. So I thought, there you go, I'll put him on a ship made of pikecrete, and I've got the ship basically heading towards a Hydra base in a Norwegian island, just because I love Hydra, man. Hydra, if I could pitch anything to Marvel right now, it would be a Hydra Max series, and I think that would kick ass. But that's just a tangent on the side, I guess. In this, it's got Cap on the ship, and I wanted to look at, it's still World War II, and everyone paints him now as this man out of time. But even back then, he grew up in the Depression era, and then he's in World War II where they're looking at rotor buggies and bloody pikecrete and all this sort of random stuff. You've got the greatest evil ever in the world has stepped up, which is obviously Hydra, not the Nazis. And he's gone from this, you know, this weakling to the ultimate man. Everything had changed for him already before he ever got frozen in ice. So I've got Steve sort of delivering this monologue to Bucky on the ship where he's talking about, he just doesn't understand the world. He doesn't understand the changes of his body, of the war, of the weapons, any of those things. And at the end, I've got him saying this line where he says, "If war is hell, why am I so damn cold?" And I was really happy with that as a final line, and it just sort of it painted for me that character where he was probably a little weary before he got frozen in ice. He would have been involved in every battle. He would have had no downtime. And in the end, I wanted my page to cut through to the character, not just a setting. And I always try to do that with any page I write on any project. I want to have a cool idea there, but I want to tie it to character as well.
It's a great line, that's nice.
Yeah, it really can be sometimes. But that's been my week writing.
That sounds really cool, man.
Yeah, thanks.
I guess for my progress report, I have two pitches that I'm currently trying to get off the ground. If anybody's visited my site, they've seen some previews that I've put up. One of them is a project, basically. It's called Southern Dog, and it's, in a nutshell, it's Teen Wolf set in the Deep South, 6 weeks before Obama's inauguration. And I was somehow able to get Riley Rossmann to do the cover, which is just brilliant. And I've pitched it to a couple people, and we'll see if I hear back. And another one, I actually just saw the work in progress from W. Scott Forbes on the cover, which is looking phenomenal. His rough was really good, and his final concept is amazing. And then I have different artists on both books, and both artists are relatively new, and they're doing really, really well. And it's quite a process to try to get two pitches done, which is, I think, about Curtis doing two books but having to write them and produce them and get them out. And it makes me think that, you know, maybe, you know, I'll just try to, we were talking before the podcast, and Curtis was like, you know, try to pace yourself and don't bite off more than you can chew. And I think that's sound, because I don't think I could do two books at the same time, especially, you know, most of us are holding day jobs. So, I'm proud of both projects. So if I can only get one through the door, that'd be great. And actually, relatively recently, I just connected with an artist on a pitch that I sent to him, and he really liked it. And so that's kind of getting the wheels turning on that project. But yeah, that's about it.
I think it's a, like I was saying to you earlier, I think it's really great to get, especially, I mean, I can say from my own experience, to have as many pitches and to meet and network with as many artists as you can and show that you have a real drive and a real ambition to get this, you know, your work published. And I think if you can have that kind of energy and that kind of excitement, and you can prove to the artists that you want to work with you, that you will be pitching this, you will be following up, you will be doing all that lifting on your end, I think that really gets artists excited. And on top of that, the more pitches you have, the better chance you have of getting something picked up. You just got to keep hitting that wall. And if you do pitch two or three things and two of them get picked up, just try to pace it in a way that you say, okay, you know, I can do this book for this, you know, for 6 months in a row, and then after that I'll do this book. And I mean, if they really like your material, then the publisher's gonna say, okay, yeah, that would work just fine. So I mean, I definitely learned the hard way how doing two books at one time can be a little stressful. So that would be a recommendation that I can give to anyone out there. Just really know what kind of free time you have before you commit to something, and be aware of how much work it actually is. And that's something that Scott Kowalczuk from Intrepids, we're going to do a podcast for the process where we're going to do an Intrepids retrospective and talk about how it was such a huge learning curve for us and a lot of the unexpected things that came up along the way. So that'll be something to look out for as well.
Yeah, I'm definitely trying to get ahead with the scripts for the Southern Dog pitch. I'm 2.5 issues in of a 5-issue miniseries, and then this other one, Sleepwalker, I'm about 1.5 issues in. And it's kind of hard because it's like I really like these stories, and I'm really, you know, really vibing with the characters, and it's coming out really just kind of smoothly. But at the same time, I don't know if I need to try to – how far I need to get in the series, because it's like if I commit all the time to, like, writing 3 issues and then it doesn't go anywhere, I could have spent – that time getting another pitch together. So it's a weird balance, but it's definitely, you need to try to find a balance. And obviously the more you have written, the less lifting you have to do if it gets through the door.
I think it can also be a good way to, if you just complete the, let's say you just do like a 4-issue and that's what you plan it to be. You, even though it's not going to get picked up, to write the whole thing anyway, because that really teaches you how to do, have the beginning, middle, and end.
Oh, that's great.
And it allows you to work towards really refining that skill. And I mean, I haven't done that with a lot of my projects. And truthfully, I've pitched, like, for instance, my book that's coming out in January. I've written the first half of the script for the first issue. And I mean, that can be a little bit scary when you have other things that are on the burner and you just don't have time to commit to it. But in that case, if you have the time, just try to finish something like that up, because you can actually hone a lot of skills just doing that.
Yeah, I'm in a similar place where I've got 3 pitches at the moment in various states. And I was thinking the other day, it'd be the worst thing in the world, if all 3 got picked up, I'd be screwed. There's no way I could keep up with doing all of it. But they're all sort of in different places, so they're staggered, which is really good. One, obviously, is waiting on 1 page of art, and then we're good to go. Another one, I'm waiting on the artist to finish another project. And then another one, I've got another artist sort of just tinkering with ideas, having a fiddle with it, and that's cool. So none of them look like they'll be finished at the same time, but it's not to say they all get picked up when they're finished. But then looking at how far I am into scripting each of them, the one that I'm about to pitch, I've probably written most of the first issue, probably about 2/3 of it, a bit over. Another one I've written maybe half the first issue. And then the other one, which would probably end up being a graphic novel, I've written all of it, but it's very much just a big blast of a first draft. And I know the revisions that need to be done, and I know the notes I've already taken on it, but I'll get to them later, I guess.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, we'll wrap this up with one final thought that I have here, and then we'll move on to the next section. But it also depends too. Like, the production time on a comic varies pretty significantly. And one of the things that happened with Intrepids is that it was picked up and it didn't come out till a year later, which means we had about 10 months of production time. So sometimes you're lucky and you have that kind of wiggle room. And sometimes on the other end of the spectrum with Green Wake, I had 3 weeks. So it can be a wide variety. And usually you can work with a publisher because they will have a publishing schedule that they can only fit your book in at a certain time. So you can buffer yourself a little bit. All right, well, let's move on to the next section. This one is called Grill'em. This is where we put questions out to you. We open up the floor for anything that you want to ask us. And so we put out a note on Twitter and on our Facebook page, and we got the first listener question was from Daniel Carroll, and he wanted to know, and here's the question, what are your thoughts on using real-world locales, and what are the pros and cons? Gentlemen?
The heist book that I'm working on at the moment, I hadn't initially really nailed down where I wanted it to be, and it was only when I started working with the artist, and he's a tattoo artist in New York, and he sort of said, hey, we should set this in New York, and he started putting it into the backgrounds of panels and things like that, and it works really well for the story. But initially, I don't really know that I'd given it a place. I don't know, sometimes I'll write a story and it doesn't have a specific locale. Do you guys ever find that?
Yeah, you know, that's something I've really struggled with doing my stories, because you always feel like this has got to be set somewhere real, or else people are going to have a hard time believing what I'm trying to do in the story, or there won't be a connection to it. But that's something that I've learned isn't really true. If you can add a lot of character to the location, or just allow it to be the background for a really interesting story, I don't think it really matters all that much, unless it is obviously significant to the story in some way.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, my stories, all of them, that you know, the three stories that I've gotten really far in, they're all based in very real locations. My graphic novel, the first one I wrote, is based in Houston, Texas. The Southern Dog is based in Fort Payne, Alabama. And then this third one, Sleepwalker, is based in Manhattan, but the main character lives in Coney Island. And, you know, for me, I like writing those stories. But, you know, it's a good question that Daniel poses, because for me, when I'm writing specific locations, I have to have everything answered. Like this new one with Sleepwalker, I went to Coney Island and I walked around. I found the house that I wanted him to live in. I walked a walk that I would think he would do, to the boardwalk, to Coney Island. And I just had it all in my mind, so when I could write it, I wasn't just guessing and making things up, because if you don't cover every base, it'll fall apart. And that's the challenge with picking a real place, is that you have to ground it and you have to have detail, especially if you know people who are going to read it know those locations. So I spend so much time just getting all those details in. My parents live in Texas, so when I'm home and they're driving on the highways, I'm taking tons of reference photos of the highways, of, you know, the neighborhoods. So it's a lot of additional work if you want to do that, and I think you need to do it in order to really sell it. But, you know, a part of me would wish I could, you know, not focus so much on those details.
Well, I think that's a really interesting element of it. You know, it helps, Jeremy, that you come from an interesting place like New York. I live in Saskatoon, and I don't think anybody would want to read a story about the town I come from. Hey, we've got a lot of dirty roads, and there's a lot of dust in the air, and that's all we got to sell. You know, like, there isn't... not a lot of interesting things happen in this town. I'm sure there are, but again, it's not like people think of, you know, the big cities like Los Angeles, New York, Saskatoon. Doesn't really happen. Doesn't hit the radar on the top 150, you know? So I think I struggle when I write locations that I have to do a lot of extra research, and you still find you're grasping at straws, you know, to get like the real details. I just have to fill in the spaces, because there's not enough information on the internet, or, you know, even reading books, to really get a really good feeling for the town, especially if you haven't been there. Like, I've never been to New York, and I've set some of my stories in London. I've never been there, and I did a lot of research on the districts, but it's not the same as having traveled there or actually having experienced the people and the location itself.
Yeah, I mean, I sent reference videos to my artist for Sleepwalker, and I took all these videos of Coney Island, and he actually sent me emails. He's like, dude, you're making this way too easy for me. Because he lives in Canada, and he's like, I've never been to New York, and I feel like now I have. And I did like a 10-minute video of me getting on a subway and riding it a bunch of stops and getting off, and, you know, the atmosphere of what it's like when people are walking around New York. And, I do feel fortunate being in all these different locations, because, you know, it kind of does a lot of that heavy lifting.
See, I live in Australia. I know lots about Australia. I've lived here all my life. But I always worry, if I set a story here, is anybody going to care?
Hell yeah.
I think so. But
I found one of my favorite movies in the last, you know, 5 years was The Proposition.
Oh, yeah. Because it kicks ass. I love that.
Well, I mean, it's not only written by Nick Cave, which is going to come into a section later on that we're going to talk about, at least for me. But it's also a Western that is set in Australia, which has some very, you know, interesting similarities to the Westerns of America. But there's also that element that is completely Australian. And I think even if you don't know anything about Australia, there was still enough there that you learned something while watching that film. And if you do know something, you could really, really love all those smaller details. And that really local history, I think, paid off really well in the story.
Oh, maybe I will use it, because, I don't know, I've been toying with an idea for a story where the superheroes are not sponsored by the government, but they end up sort of working as peace enforcers, I guess. And I want to follow a set of them that basically in each major city, they get a decommissioned firehouse and they set up teams of superheroes that sort of live in the firehouse, and they're that city's sort of super team. And I want that story to be Australian. I want it to have the Sydney locale. I want it to have that sort of backdrop. I want it to have – Australia is much smaller than America. We're a lot more laid back. We could handle just having like one team. We don't need the Avengers and the Fantastic Four and Spider-Man and Daredevil in Sydney. We need like two guys, and they'd be able to cover it all. And so –
Ryan, do you have an – oh, go ahead.
No, no, you go.
I mean, what I think that you have an advantage of is that, you know, I could personally go visit Australia and spend like a week there and try to get all the information I can. But because you've lived there, as far as writing is concerned, you could write a lot of local slang into it that, you know, people from Australia would get, but would also be accessible to people who weren't. And it's, I find writing different locations, as a writer, you have to get that language down. When I was writing a story set in Texas, I needed to get this Texas slang out. And fortunately, I lived there long enough to hear it enough. But I think that's an advantage you have if you were to write a story set in Australia.
Yeah, we've got that sort of patois that's a bastardized version of the baby of Trainspotting and A Clockwork Orange. So, yeah, people aren't going to get it, but they'll find it interesting, I guess. So, yeah, I would really, especially being Australian, I'd just love to have a story that was set in Australia because nothing – I mean, you look at how we're represented in comics. We've got – what is that idiot's name from G.I. Joe? It's he's a bad character, and we've got was it Captain Boomerang or whatever? Like, it's there's not a lot of great opportunity. We've got Eden Feasy in Secret Warriors, which I think he's a really cool character. And other than that, we're marginalized. And so I wonder if I did a book set in Australia, whether that could turn people on or off. So, but then the other opportunity I have is to write a story set in America like everybody else does. And the graphic novel that I'm working on is basically I mentioned it last week, it's the country music road trip across America. And I was actually talking to Scott Snyder about it and sort of going back and forth on it. And he said, you know what, it really gets to the heart of America, and you could really – I want to set it just before the Vietnam War, just as television is becoming that boom with news, because when that happened, news became instant. And I want that to mirror this story so that the lead character on this road trip, he's got that sort of – it's part Beatlemania, it's part Charles Starkweather, and it's just all insane demon fun. And so it's going – and it doesn't really matter where it goes in America, but that it obviously has to go through America. It's sort of like a sequel to – you guys know the song Devil Went Down to Georgia?
Yeah.
At the end of that song, he's like, I done told you once, you son of a bitch, I'm the best there's ever been. As if you say that to the devil and he doesn't smite you in some way. Like, he's just an arrogant ass. And so basically in my story, the devil just turns around and is like, well, you've won and I can't kill you right now. But that doesn't mean I can't send everyone I know to kill you because they're not me. And so basically he does, Johnny has to go cross country trying to evade these demons. And so when Scott Snyder said that, he was like, this could really, like, you know, it could say something about America. I was like, do you think that's going to annoy people that an Australian is saying that about America? So I don't know. I'm sure we could get away with it, but it'd be interesting.
Have you ever thought of just setting that in Australia?
Well, because it builds – the first fifth of the story is sort of like my version of the retelling of that song. I say retelling because I think I can change it enough that I won't be sued or anything like that. But it does follow that whole Georgian aspect of it, and it is something that I kind of want to keep, but it could work in Australia. It'd be something
you're
to
actually,
think about.
Ryan, you actually brought up another good point about actually using real-world locales, is that you have to worry about, you know, actual restaurants and street signs and businesses. Like, I wrote a story that was based in downtown Houston, and I use a restaurant that's similar to McDonald's, but I couldn't use McDonald's. So a part of me was like, you know, I think Jonathan Hickman did it in the Nightly News, where he actually uses, you know, the news organizations like NBC, CNN. And I think the way he got away with it was saying some kind of disclaimer at the beginning, saying I forget what it was, but he was able to use the actual names. And, you know, that's also a challenge, is that you want to set in the real life, but you can't use those real, I don't know, just businesses and names and companies. So you have to kind of make a workaround, and you don't want to go too far where they don't understand what that company is supposed to represent, when it could be something as simple as McDonald's, I guess.
Right.
So.
Yeah, you don't want to have that confusion. I mean, Kurt, have you had any issues with the people of Greenwake saying that, you know, you screwed over the way you've written their town?
Yeah, they haunt me nightly. It's all they don't leave me alone when I'm sleeping.
That's called writer's block, man. Be careful.
Yeah. Well, I guess hopefully that answers the question. I think we discussed it fairly well. Ryan, why don't we move on to the next portion of the podcast? You wanted to introduce it, so I'll hand the reins over to you.
Thanks, mate. This part is the process. This is the meat of what we're talking about, how we actually write and what helps us. Now, last week we just sort of talked about horror in general. This week we're going on a different tangent. We're going to be looking at music. So we want to look at how it influences our writing, what we listen to while we're writing, who's on our playlist, all those sorts of questions. So to kick things off, I would say I listen to music a lot when I write. And I try to make sure that it's music that's not obtrusive, and that generally means they don't have lyrics. How do you guys find that?
Yeah, I'm the same way. It has to have very little lyrics, mostly instrumental, because oftentimes I find it'll drag me out of my headspace, because I'll catch the lyrics and it just kind of replaces the words with my own, and I just totally lose it at that point.
Yeah, I would agree. I actually don't listen to a lot of music until after I've done a first draft. I have to basically write in silence. But when I'm writing, when I have a really good session going, I fall into, the best thing I can describe it as is a trance. I've done it where I'm on a subway and I would burn through like five solid pages that literally I months later wouldn't have to edit, but you know, I probably miss my subway stop or whatnot, but I just get into it. And I just write, and I don't need any music, but I use music to kind of reinforce those thoughts I was having. So I pick a song that I think is kind of plays that kind of tone that I was going for, and I reread the script and play it with music and see if it still vibes.
Nice. When I look at a soundtrack, I always go on eBay and just try and find cheap soundtracks that are getting around, and I've picked up all sorts of random stuff there, which has been cool. But I've got a playlist of just all the different soundtracks, but I still find I play them in order. So usually a soundtrack will reflect what I'm trying to write. So Braveheart, that soundtrack is one that gets massive play for me and always has. Things like Fight Club is a different soundtrack to Braveheart. And so it's for a different writing project, but I find that works. I've picked up Donnie Darko. Taxi Driver is a really atmospheric soundtrack. I really dig that one. Same with stuff like the Man with the Golden Arm, the old Sinatra movie. Mm-hmm. But I managed to pick up recently a whole bunch of old Cronenberg movie scores. And nice. Those things are just eerie. They are really, really atmospheric, but they almost send you into a trance where you just sort of you just mellow out and you're not noticing what's around you. And I find the same with Dario Argento scores done by Goblin. They're a little more erratic, but stuff like that really, really works for me. And I know, Kurt, you'll probably talk more about it now, but the soundtrack for The Proposition absolutely kicks ass.
Yeah, I saw that movie a few years ago and it didn't get a wide release here at all, I don't think. And luckily, the city I live in is small. We have a local theater that plays kind of more independent films, and that, I guess, that was on the indie radar and it played here. And oh man, that atmosphere and they're just the really haunting music. A lot of instrumental. Warren Ellis accompanies Nick Cave for the soundtrack. Not the Warren Ellis, the writer, but he's obviously a musician. And yeah, lots of violins and sad piano and. That's what I wrote my novel to, and it definitely had some influence on Green Wake. That was something that was when I wrote the first script, I was listening to that. And recently, when I was having trouble writing Green Wake, the more recent issues, I heard of a band called the Black Atlantics, and
oh, yeah.
they have lyrics, but it's so it's so subtle, you barely register what they're singing over top of this really eerie, haunting melody. And I think those are the two that have really carried me through a lot of writing blocks and really helped get me in a somber mood, which is, you really have to do that when you're writing. You have to get into a headspace of whatever you're trying to write. You have to be able to get that kind of emotion, or just, it's when you finish writing it, you know it's fake. I don't know if you guys come across that where you're just like, I phoned this in because I wasn't feeling it.
For me, the two soundtracks that I've listened to the most to get me in the right headspace is The Social Network score by Trent Reznor is amazing. And actually, the Twin Peaks soundtrack, I've been listening to a lot of for, and it's kind of doing research for kind of this 50s hard-boiled detective story, and it's also obviously very atmospheric, but yeah.
I find, and you make that good point, Kurt, that you want to get in that mood when you're writing, and all of us have our day jobs. We don't have an hour to sit down and get in that mood. You've got to do it quickly. You've got to woo yourself without the foreplay, if you will. And music does that, man. Much like the bedroom, music will set that scene really, really quickly and really, really effectively. And so I find you put on that music, and within about 5 minutes, within about a track or two, you're in that zone, you're in that place, and you can quickly. And it's one thing I've learned more and more. Sometimes I'll only have half an hour to write. And you've got to turn and burn those 30 minutes and make them really productive. And I find having that music in the background, it's like a shortcut, and it gets you right where you need to be. What music have you most recently listened to while writing, guys?
Go ahead, Jeremy.
For me, for Southern Dog, obviously it's set in the South. There's a country musician, Ryan Bingham, that I really have gotten into. I actually got into him through, of all people, Jason Aaron actually posted on his blog about one of his songs. So I listened to it and I was like, oh God, this is like this, you know, this country guy who's just down on his luck. And, you know, the real story behind him is that, you know, he was homeless and he was doing rodeo shows and he wanted to just be a musician, and he happened to just keep playing and was living out of people's barns and whatnot. And then he just struck gold and got a record deal, and now, I mean, the rest is history. And one of his songs was on that Jeff Bridges film,
Crazy Heart.
Yeah, Crazy Heart. Brian Bingham did the song for that film, which I think was nominated for an Oscar or whatnot. But yeah, I mean, that kind of music really gets me, because it's kind of regional, and I needed music that kind of took me back to the years I spent in high school in Texas and whatnot. So it's when I pick music, it's got to be kind of regional.
See, and here I thought you were going to say Southern Dog brought to you by the Dixie Chicks. Disappointed.
No, it's a pretty dark story. So I need some, you know, like you guys said, you need to kind of get into that. You got to kind of depress yourself, which is really strange to say, but you got to really think sad things. At least I write very sad things. I know Curtis certainly does, because when I read his stuff, I feel very sad. But you got to kind of convince yourself and yeah, just, you know, woo yourself, like you said, Ryan.
Yeah, I say that completely.
I've been listening to, right now I'm in the process of writing kind of the arc, the story, the issue synopsis for the next arc of Green Wake. And it's a fine line that I'm trying to balance, because really I can't go on the same status quo for the next arc. I have to in some ways reinvent the story so that it's still interesting while staying true to what I've been building in the first five. So I'm balancing this very, very small rope, and it's musically I've had to come to a new sound to help me through the writing process. And what I'm listening to right now is Band of Horses. I don't know if you guys listen to
that. Yeah, absolutely.
They're really great, because they border a lot of different sounds. They border like a folk sound to kind of more indie country, and to a real melodic, lots of harmonies, really simple, catchy guitar riffs. And they've been really great as far as just a really calming, just to get my mind to slow down for 5 minutes, because I can be thinking about 100 things at once, all the things that I got to do. I just got to put that all away. And having a really calming music helps me slow my mind down and focus on at the task at hand. So Band of Horses is what I'm listening to right now. And then also if I need to switch gears and just move on to the next project, I'll quickly throw on a band called Mother Mother. And they're a Canadian band that has a very bizarre sound. In their first album, they had this song that was all about the singers. It's a male and a female. And the girl is singing about how she's having sex with this guy in a barn, and the whole song is about her dad coming in with a shotgun. And it's the funniest song, but it's so catchy. If you guys can ever listen to their stuff, they're really great. Mother Mother, they're a really fun band. So those are the things that I've been listening to lately.
Have you guys seen the movie The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah.
See, I haven't, but I got the soundtrack, and I love it. It's
it's awesome.
It's like French versions of Bowie songs, and I think it's French. I don't know, but the brilliance of it is they're good, catchy tunes, and it's got this sort of somewhere between pop and operatic scope, and I can't get caught up in the lyrics because I don't understand them. So I just have that in the background, and it's working at the moment perfectly for the project that I'm writing. So that's been one. And the other is there's an Australian artist called Sarah Blasco. I don't know if you guys have heard of her. But she is amazing. She just has this really, really soothing voice. And she's definitely not a pop singer, but it's sort of hard to categorize her at times. But she got 4 albums, and you can put all of them onto a bit of shuffle, and they work for me really, really well, because even though there's lyrics there, it's more the tone and meter of the song that sort of carries me away, and then I can get into the writing. It's really, really good background music. The other thing I would say before we move off this section is just going into iTunes and setting it on shuffle sometimes is it's a dangerous proposition, but I find sometimes it can yield really interesting results. I'm a big fan of writing, for me at least, is an art that is born of that very moment. So if I get up at 8 o'clock and start writing, that page is phenomenally different, I feel, than what that page would have been if I woke up at 9 o'clock and started writing it. I feel that any sort of influence that I have on my day and change of time, or when I think of an idea, it's all based on external influences. So I'm interested sometimes to see different songs. Like if you're writing along and then the shuffle hits you onto Bust a Move, there's a song I'm not used to writing to, but it may spark a different idea. I don't know. It's something that I feel sometimes you've got to let writing, because writing is an art, be a little experimental and be a little surprising. So I don't know if you guys have ever done that, just hit shuffle and sort of seen whether it ruins your page or not.
I have, and I've done that, and I end up getting Regina Spektor, who basically just takes my brain and kicks it out my ear, and yeah, totally. I can't do anything for the rest of the day. God love her, but
I've got a lot of death metal on my music list, so every time I'll be listening to what I need to be, and then all of a sudden Himsa or the Bronx or the Sword come on, and they're screaming in my ear, and I love it, but it's like, oh, I just want to sit back and listen to this right now, and I can't write, so.
Yeah, I'll get stuck if Electric Light Orchestra, ELO, if they come on the shuffle. Man, I love those guys, but then I'll find I'm singing, not writing. So that's a little counterproductive.
Okay, so I guess the next section is the roundtable, which is, I guess, the discussion for today's episode is about letting the art do the talking and when to let go of the scene and as a writer and let the artist kind of take over. So I guess, Ryan, if you want to start.
I've caught up on Brian Wood's DMZ, which you'd mentioned in the last pod, Jeremy. I caught up on all those trades over the last probably about 6 months. And, man, he uses a lot of establishing shots. And maybe they'll have one caption with them, but most of the time it's just New York is a character in that story, and he just really wants to sell it. And nearly every issue opens with just a page of establishing art. And I think I'd love to add up how many pages of that entire work is just establishing shots, because, man, and I even said something about it on Twitter, and Brian Wood said back to me, yeah, an establishing shot's worth its weight in gold. And I think that they're definitely just letting the art speak for it. It's a cross between the scene and the tone of what you're talking about, because just the scene of New York is interesting, but then watching the issue where planes are flying over and just starting to drop bombs, that's powerful, that sets tone. And
Sure.
Yeah, it's just it's an amazing use of art. And Frank Miller did a lot of the same stuff, especially in Daredevil. He always used those tall establishing shots on the left of the panel, and they were always really good to just drop you into the scene. And usually it was like a shot of a building, and you'd have a word balloon coming from the building, and then you'd go in the next panel inside the building to see who was talking. But most of the time it didn't matter who was saying what, it was that art. So I think definitely in that vein it works. But when it comes to the inside of an issue, if you will, once scene has been established, I'll be the first to admit letting the art speak for itself isn't my strength. I love words too much, sadly, which why am I in comics, some might say, but I think you can, as long as you can match it with a good balance. If you're overriding it, that's terrible, but sometimes you need to let the art sell it. I mean, Kurt, in Greenwake, man, Riley carries some serious sequences, I gotta say.
Yeah, that was in the first script for issue one. I think what happened was we actually had an issue with. I mean, as you write scripts, you realize that you have your evens and your odd pages, and your odd pages, you always kind of have to have a mini beat as a little mini cliffhanger to keep the pages flipping. And what happened was in that sequence where Carl is walking through town, Riley, he did an extra page accidentally. And so it threw off all my beats for the rest of the issue and made it a page longer. And he just basically, we took a look at the page and, I kept on looking at it. I think it ended up being a 2.5, almost 3-page sequence of Carl just walking through town. And I was like, no, we can't cut this. Like, no, it's too, it's too good. And we ended up making, I think we just adjusted it like a page after where we combined 2 pages and it worked out fine. But that Riley's been able to, and I think this comes down to really being able to trust the person you're working with. And that comes with a lot of time working with each other. After I saw that, I'm like, you know what? I can do this all the time with Riley and there's never going to be an issue. I love doing that. I love just having, you know, 3 pages where I don't have to put in a word and I just describe, you know, a little bit of detail, what I need to see happen. And he just fills it in. And there's in issue 5, which I think I sent both of you guys already, you've probably read it, but the sequence at the end, I won't spoil anything. That sequence at the end, I didn't write any dialogue for it until the last few pages. And I knew, because I could see how Riley was going to do it in my head, I knew it was going to be powerful. And then when he actually sent me the art for it, I got chills. And you can really, if you have that trust with your artist, there's, man, the pays dividends. And especially when you work really tightly. And I think it comes out a lot more in creator-owned stuff because you're both so invested in seeing this thing succeed and you have a lot of emotional investment in the story. It really comes out in that situation. So it's a lot easier to allow the art to do the talking. But as a side note, in the first printing of Greenwake number 1, page 23, which looks like I let the art do the talking, actually had the lettering missing. So there's also that addendum to it as well, where your words are taken away accidentally, and that's painful.
Yeah, that's you put all the effort into that. You don't want to see it missing, that's for sure. But I was going to bring up issue 5, and I won't say anything too spoilery, but, man, yeah, that sequence where Riley just sort of drew it all, that was – I was thinking at the time of reading it, that's a lot of restraint not to put a caption here or a little bit of something there. You're putting some ownership on the reader as well to be smart enough to follow along and work it out, and I think that's a very bold move.
Yeah, we'll see how it pays off. Not to say that anything with the readers, but I hope I've put enough in that it makes it clear that it isn't just completely nonsense, that there is actually something holding it all together. But, you know, we'll see. It comes out in a few weeks. So,
Curtis, for the first page of issue 5, the panels, the way that they're drawn, did you describe that? The 2 panels?
On the very first page?
Yeah, the way that they're just drawn in, like, horizontally.
I didn't say that they were, like, laid out like that. I just said they were side-by-side shots.
Nice.
So that we had that comparative. I very rarely take control of how the paneling is done because Riley does such a great job of it. But if that was kind of a parallel, I was trying to have, you know, one image so you think one thing and another. And for me, that was important. There isn't very many times where I do that, though. Riley's kind of left his own device for that. Sometimes you have to take ownership, but generally the artist knows what they're doing.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, I've realized through my own process, my first script I wrote was extremely, extremely wordy. And the next one, once I started seeing art for them, that kind of changed my perspective on my whole process because I realized when I started writing, I thought almost nothing of the art because honestly, when I was writing it, I didn't even think I was going to find an artist. But now that I'm networking and finding artists relatively quickly, my third project is probably the least bare-bones script I've ever written because, you know, I knew exactly what art I was looking for. And when I found that, I knew that I had to let, you know, my artist do the talking for me. And he, you know, can do that. And I think that you can only learn that if you get the work done and you get the pages in your face and you can see your words come to life.
Yeah, totally. My scripts, Well, even for Intrepids, because I wrote the first issue of Intrepids without an artist, and without even an artist in mind. And that was actually, truthfully, the hardest part about Intrepids was to find the artist that would work for it. I mean, I looked at a lot of different art styles, and I just couldn't even visualize how it was going to look, because, I mean, you take an artist and it could totally change the voice of the story. And that's what happened. Intrepids was originally more of a dark story, truthfully. Like in the first issue, there's a decapitation. And after Scott came on board and did that, I was like, man, that just doesn't suit it. His style doesn't really suit a really heavy, not a heavy, but, you know, just a darker storyline. I was kind of pitching it as a dark comedy. And that actually obviously changed when Scott came on board. It became a lot more lighthearted. But the descriptions, like, each panel had, you know, three or four sentences each panel. And as soon as Scott came on and did the first issue, that totally went out the window, because I was able to just say, side shot of Crystal, overhead shot of Doyle. Literally, I'm not even kidding. Like, it all came down to me writing the dialogue, where Scott would full control over the camera, unless it was really significant. I just literally would do one or two sentence summaries, and Scott was able to fill it in very nicely. And the more you work with someone and trust them, and you can see, especially if they have a skill for, you know, for the camera, you don't really have to say much at all.
Absolutely.
I love that page in the first issue of the Intrepids where Crystal shoots the cyber bear and it lands at her feet. That is one of the best pages this year. I love the shit out of that page. There's not a lot of writing on that page, if any, from memory. And it's just
a sound effect, I think.
Yeah, and it's just sold complete. It just looks badass. Like, that was, yeah. I if he ever wants to sell that page, I'll buy it. Let him know.
I'll see what he says about that. He listens to the podcast, so maybe he'll hit you up.
Oh, excellent. Well, he's only the greatest artist working today. He's, you know, he's phenomenal. I love you, Scott. do you guys find, I mean, you guys have probably read some of the script work of Alan Moore, where he lets the artist do the talking sometimes, but it's very much the artist as a sock puppet. His scripts are quite intense to the point of being almost laborious. What do you guys think of that? And do you go away from that style, or are you somewhere in between?
I think it's an extreme. I mean, I've read some of Grant Morrison's scripts. I know that a friend of mine was doing sample pages for Marvel, and he tossed the Grant Morrison script my way, and I read it. And he actually said, as an artist, it was frustrating because Grant Morrison, like, wrote almost nothing. And it was literally up to the artist to even write some of the dialogue. And when he read the actual pages that were printed in this issue of Batman, and when he looked at his own pages, they were completely different because there was nothing there. And I guess some artists like that. But, you know, I think Grant Morrison and Alan Moore are like these extremes where they're so talented in what they do, they can kind of just, you know, it's more of their persona and who they are. And it's like, oh, man, Grant Morrison's awesome. Whatever he does is great. And same with Alan Moore. But it's like, I don't know. I kind of like being in the middle.
Yeah, I think it really can depend on who you're working with, too. Some artists, they actually desire a little bit more direction, so they have to think less about the actual layout and camera work. They can focus on the actual art in the panels, whereas some really like to take the page as a whole and treat each page, even though it's paneled separately, you know, it's broken up into panels. They like the ability to take that whole scene and cue it all together visually so that each page is a work of art in itself. And I think if you have to really tailor the style you're writing towards that. I find myself right in the middle. I can take fairly excessive control when I feel there's a really important element coming up in the story. Or if it's like an action sequence or something where I feel a lot of the weight is put on the artist, I just kind of pull it back and say generally what I need to happen in each panel and allow them to go crazy. Some of the stuff coming up in issue 6, Scott has sent me the art for it, and Christ, it's fun, and there's a lot of energy, and I would say 98% of that is the art, because the script, I was like, I don't know if this is even going to work.
I mean, go ahead, Ryan.
I was just going to say, I saw some of the back material for Mark Miller's Nemesis that he did with Steve McNiven, and they showed a script excerpt where basically Miller just says, oh, give me a 3-page sequence of violence. And that was basically all of the instruction he gave McNiven for those 3 pages, and McNiven cut loose on them, and they're awesome-looking pages. But Miller, he didn't really – not that he didn't care what happened. He had complete faith, I guess, in the artist for something to come through, and I guess if you know your artist – that can work. And if you understand how, I mean, I go to the local drink and draw here, and so there's more artists there than writers. And some of them will say, you know, I want some direction. I want to know what somebody looks like or what they're wearing sometimes. And then other artists are like, no, just tell me the character and I'll spitball something together that we can agree on, and then we can move forward. So, yeah, I think you just have to know your artist.
Yeah, I think you know, this whole process of working with an artist, you know, the best way to describe it from my experience, and I think you guys could agree, is that it's an organic thing. And you can't be married to your scripts. If you go in trying to find somebody and you are constantly finding yourself saying no, I mean, it's just not going to gel. And you know, the work that gets out there, the work that everyone's buying, is the collaboration of two people that, you know, trusted each other and treated in this organic fashion where it's kind of give and take, and you know, you've got to be able to compromise and you know, in the best of ways. So I think that's really important to think about for anybody out there that's trying to write, to just, you know, kind of, you got to kind of trust who you're working with, and obviously it helps to get to know them, but you know, you gotta let some of your stuff go sometimes.
I think that's a good summary of that topic. What do you think?
I actually have just one more thing to add, which is, have you guys read Old Man Logan?
Yes.
Yeah.
The Mark Miller one. I read that in a big sitting, and I think there was over half an issue's worth of just shots of the spider buggy. Now, I don't think that's sensible use of letting the art do the talking. There was seriously, you add up the splashes and the half splashes and the double splash over an issue of just watching the spidey buggy do shit. That's that's not quality comics for me, and that would be my final take. Although when I look at my writing, I realize I don't write a lot of splashes, but I was talking to Sean Phillips on Twitter the other day about Criminal. They've only ever had one splash page in over 20 issues. So I guess sometimes it depends on what story you're writing, perhaps.
Good. Yeah. I use them a decent amount, so I usually use them as a cliffhanger. You'll notice.
Yeah, they work well.
All right, well, why don't we wrap things up, guys? We're right at the end here, and I think, Ryan, I think you wanted to take care of this one.
Yeah, guys, it's been a great chat. I just wanted to summarize something that I've been thinking about, and it ties into writing. There's a quote that I love, and it sits above my desk with a bunch of other writing quotes, and it's from Anton Chekhov, and he famously said, "Don't tell me the moon is shining. Show me the glint of light on broken glass." Now, that's just a really brilliant way of saying show, don't tell. But I was trying to think recently of how that can apply to writing comics, because comics is a visual medium. Now, obviously, if you think back to the olden golden days of Stan Lee comics, you know, he was a guy who managed to both show and tell you what was going on, and often did it redundantly. But there was a beloved quality to his style, at least. I think he could get away with it, but I don't think anyone really can get away with it these days. So when you write a script, you write plenty of words that the audience never sees, which I think is really sort of important to think about. You're writing all those directions to the artist, and you're writing your proposal and your issue breakdowns, and no one's ever going to really see those. You write down what you want the reader to see, and if you've got a good artist, as we discussed, they can do that really, really well. They're admirable at their job. So all that leaves then is maybe 20% of the writing you do that actually ends up on the page. And you can't use your words to show the glint of light on broken glass, because the artist's already done that. So yeah, I think what you have to think about when writing a comic is, more than any other writing really, what purpose do your words serve? I mean, this should be the topmost thought whenever you're writing captions and dialogue, the words that go on the page. What purpose do those words serve? Now, there's plenty of things your words can do on the page, but you might ask yourself, what are they actually doing there? Are they doing what they're doing redundantly, or can they do what they're doing better? If you want your words to show inner turmoil in the character, do you want to do this by having your character say or think they're unhappy? Do you want to tell the artist to show that character grimacing, or is there a more subtle way that you can have them not answer the phone or drop a glass or something else that could be more subtle? Maybe you can try all three and do three different drafts of the scripts and see which work better. But in the end, there's no prescribed way to get your intended purpose across to the page, and I think that's what's really important. There's dozens of right ways to do it, and there's scores of wrong ways. The trick's to experiment, redraft, and actually think about what you're doing and what the purpose is. So writing is a different comic. It's a different beast, and it's one Chekhov I have no doubt didn't think about when he made his famous quote, but it's something I think every comic writer really needs to think about. You have to assess your words that you're getting across that are on the page, and if they're filler, scrap them. But most importantly, if it's the glint of your character's inner light off their broken glass, maybe you can leave those words. But otherwise, you just need to make sure what you're doing really serves a purpose. So thanks for listening, guys. It's been a pleasure having you all download the pod and enjoy our chat. We've been Curtis Weeb, Jeremy Holt, and Ryan K. Lindsay, and hopefully you'll join us again in a few weeks for The Process.